The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kotowski. On this week's program, we have a bevy of Facebook news, from meeting of the minds between Mark Zuckerberg, Rupert Murdoch, and various other media moguls, the social network's newfound relationship with Yahoo, and the latest on the free speech scandal that rocked that virtual world. Charles Arthur will be telling us whether a piece of Estonian malware, DNS changer, will take down the web. And he speaks with author, Oscar award-winning documentary filmmaker, and software pioneer Charles Ferguson about his take on the demise of the mighty Microsoft and why big companies start to fail in middle age. Keep listening to the next 30 minutes of Tech Weekly from The Guardian. It started spreading in 2007, but only this week its effects have truly been felt. DNS changer, a piece of malware from Estonia, threatens to shut down over 300,000 infected PCs. Charles, this sounds pretty damaging. What is it?
It's, well, as you say, it's a piece of malware. What it does is it changes the DNS settings. So that is the settings within your computer which go and look up when you type guardian.co.uk. It goes and looks up with a domain name server what the numerical string should be to go to connect to that.
So that's things like 192.168.1.1, which
exactly.
We see a lot of those types of things.
Exactly. Although that won't just be your internal network, because 192 is reserved for just local networks.
Oh.
But yes, that would be the sort of thing.
Okay.
Or from later on this year, probably you'd start to see an even bigger string because you'd need to move to IPv6. But that's what they did. They set up they set this malware which would change the DNS settings on both Windows and Mac machines and would redirect people's queries, their web queries, to their own DNS servers. Now, what the DNS servers then did was they would serve up most of the content of the page that was required, but they'd change things like the adverts in it, and they'd also block connections to antivirus downloads. So you didn't realize particularly that you had this malware because you still would get Guardian.co.uk, but the adverts, had you known it, would be slightly different. And also your antivirus wouldn't be able to update in order to get rid of the malware that's on your system. So
what was the purpose? Was it just japes, or is it something a little bit more?
It's money, because they were redirecting their own advertising, or advertising that they'd sort of arbitraged, to the people who'd been infected. So they collected about $14 million, according to the FBI's estimate, over the 4 years. And that's with about 4 million computers infected at the maximum period. Not that profitable, but you know, if you're
sort as a, of, as a you're little sideline,
malware, yeah, sidelines go, not a bad one.
So what they didn't do things like capture keystrokes or anything like that.
No.
So if you went to an online retailer, you'd stick your your credit card details in, and in some cases, the keystroke capturer device technology virus would keep that and then use it again for its own services.
They don't seem to install keyloggers or anything like this, although quite possibly that sort of thing might have been part of a, if they lumped together a big lot of drive-by downloads. Gangs like this tend not to think small. They tend to want to go with, we'll do the keylogger and the DNS changer, and we'll do the this, and we'll do the Zeus Trojan for banking stuff. You might as well collect everything while you can. Why do one when you can do a dozen? But the effects of DNS changer itself were quite limited to just this advertising redirect.
So ultimately, it wasn't necessarily taking things from us as users. It was more basically bamboozling advertisers.
Yeah, it was taking away there. And of course, it was preventing you getting the antivirus uploads or downloads, rather, which means that your machine was not as protected. So you could have been open to other malware as well in the meantime.
But basically, this system, this was stopped quite a while ago. So it's not active anymore. So what's happening with the PCs and the Macs that are still infected?
Well, the FBI and associated organisations in Estonia made a number of arrests. They made 6 arrests in November of 2011. And the DNS servers, which are based in the US, that they've been using, were going to be shut down. But then they realised that for all these people, it would mean that their computers would go offline. And it would just sort of do that abruptly. They'd type in an address and it wouldn't resolve. So what they decided to do was the FBI got a court order so that the servers could be kept up, but they would sort of incorporate warnings. And every time someone came via one of those DNS servers, the idea was that Google or whoever would serve up a warning, say, hey, you should change the DNS settings on your machine. You should get a antivirus update and so on. And so these servers were working in effect like proper servers should, but equally, they were trying to warn people. Now the FBI has said, okay, that's enough money poured into this. We're going to turn the plug off. And on Monday, July the 9th, that's what they did. No signs yet of any enormous problems, but of course it's kind of early to say.
We haven't yet been to lots of different sites.
Well, it's one of those things where, in a world when you have millions and millions of people online, if you get a few hundred thousand not being online, especially given they might be using mobile phones and things to get online as well.
So this is also affected.
Know?
This would have also affected.
No, it wouldn't affect mobile phones. It only affects PCs, only affects Windows and Macs, and only if people had been infected in this way. So there's about 350,000 machines, goes the calculation. Not mobiles and not routers, but it's the sort of thing which could have an effect.
Is it a particularly sophisticated attack? I like the fact that, there is a bit of a safety valve for there's a kind of legacy for the bad guys, as it were, the malware operators.
It's one which is pretty hard to spot. The fact that your computer's DNS is going to somewhere unusual, most people would not notice that at all. Why would you notice most people don't take any notes of the ads on a page. So if the DNS is otherwise resolving okay, then, so as long as you type in Google and it goes to Google, rather than going to, hey, my wacky search engine.co.uk, then...
Have you got that one, Charles?
Yes, I've
tried. That's a good one. That's a good one.
then you don't really notice it. So it's very subtle.
And so how will people know if they've been infected, and how can they avoid?
Well, because the computer won't go to, you type in Google, nothing happens.
But if you were to type in
a numerical IP address, just try anything random, actually, 174.109.10.50, see where it goes.
Oh.
And numerical numbers will resolve.
Do you know where that goes?
But no idea.
Oh.
Somewhere in the UK, I think.
Is it? Oh, well, try that number. What was it?
174.104.9050.
Yeah, there you go. Try that and send us a
Make
tweet.
Make a friend.
Yeah, send a tweet at GuardianTW and let us know where you land. I'm curious. I'm going to go home and try that myself. So what can people do?
They can, they'll have to ring their ISPs if they don't know how to change their DNS settings themselves. But on Windows machines and Mac machines, if you have another avenue of getting onto the web, it's pretty straightforward to do. Use a mobile, look it up on that, and you can find how to reset your DNS.
Find out more at guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, this week, there's been quite a lot of news in the Facebook camp. First up, the social network has agreed to shake hands and have no hard feelings with Yahoo, a content company, a search engine, an advertising system. Ugh, God only knows what it is. Charles, what is Yahoo?
The big banner advert of the web.
Well, actually, that's relevant to this conversation. Isn't that what they have agreed on, their advertising?
Yeah, they've ended their patent lawsuits, which never looked like a very good idea. It looked a bit, it made Yahoo look a bit desperate, to be honest. They were all started under Scott Thompson, who's now the ex-Yahoo chief executive because of the irregularities over his CV. He was kicked out earlier this year, and Ross Levinson, who's the interim chief executive, and for some people is the front runner to be the full-time one, he decided to settle, basically. So the row that was edging up between Facebook and Yahoo, where Microsoft was an interesting intermediary. Microsoft bought a whole lot of patents from, I believe, AOL early this year, and then passed them on, although Microsoft is a partner with Yahoo, Microsoft passed them on to Facebook.
But Microsoft is also a partner with Facebook.
Well, yes, it owns a chunk of Facebook.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Microsoft was a bit torn in this, but clearly it sees Facebook as the more important one to be the good friend of. And so Facebook had a bigger armory of patents if it really needed to fight this in a court with Yahoo and to sort of sling these things back and forth, which, to be honest, is never a very effective way of doing commercial battle, because as the Google Oracle case showed earlier this year, you know, actually you can fight yourself to a standstill. Oracle spent millions and millions of dollars on that lawsuit. What it ended up with was having lots of its patents busted to nothing, and it got about $50 and change from it. And I don't think it got awarded damages. You know, it didn't get awarded costs either. So really, it's not
the only
a very
people
effective
who made
way.
Money there were the lawyers.
It's the lawyers. Yeah. The lawyers are happy, yeah. But you know, Yahoo and Facebook, Yahoo particularly, which really needs to hang on to the money.
Yeah, where does this leave Yahoo? Because it sounds like they're the ones who backed down.
Yeah, well, Yahoo is, as you say, it's the one that backed down because it was just being made to look sort of silly and sort of like the grumpy parent sort of thing. But I think that while there's no clear big future for Yahoo, it's not going to suddenly sputter out. It's not going to go like a sun sort of reaching the end of its life and turn into a red dwarf and burn out. Not in the way that some people, for example, are looking at RIM, you know, BlackBerry Maker, and thinking these guys have only got months to live if something doesn't turn around.
I have a feeling, just as an aside, that there may be a Tech Weekly drinking game in which people drink when they hear us talking about RIM every week. Yeah. Hey, they talked about RIM. Anyway, okay. Sorry, continue.
I think, you know, Yahoo can continue for years and years, actually. You know, it might gradually get smaller and it'll just be a sort of asymptotic shrinking, you know, that it will sort of never quite reach zero. It just fades away like Zeno's arrow.
There was I remember on Twitter just a few weeks ago, there was a real flutter about Flickr, which is a Yahoo property. What do you remember what that storm was? What was brewing there?
I don't particularly. I think there was some suggestion that they were looking at changing licensing. But, Flickr is one of the assets that Yahoo has, and they'd be crazy to try to sell it because actually that's one of the things they can you know, make money with.
And finally, Sheryl Sandberg, who is the newest member of the board, made the announcement from the Facebook side, obviously a newest member of the board of Facebook. Do you think this announcement is significant? I know that there are rumors going around that she's got some pretty lofty intentions with what she'd like to do with her career.
Yeah, she's Sheryl Sandberg has been suggested as a sort of a potential political candidate, you know, could aim for highest office. Let's hope she doesn't sort of end up in Veep like the Armando Iannucci thing, which is the sort of the hopeless office, the one that does nothing. I mean, no, as the chief operating officer at Facebook, she's pretty powerful. It'd be interesting to see just how powerful she makes Facebook and herself before, you know, if she looks to springboard off to something big. But I think the fact that she was the one who announced this for Facebook is interesting. It's basically her saying, this is us getting business done. It'll be very interesting to see what their numbers are at the end of this month. July 26th, they're going to announce their quarterly results, which is quite late, actually, for a company. You know, 26th, you'd expect that for pretty much an all-electronic company, Google is going to have its results on Friday the 13th or 14th, so, you know, within a couple of weeks of the end of the quarter. But Facebook, it's taking more than 3 weeks to have its numbers, which is surprising.
Does their flotation have anything to do with it?
Well, I think it's because they're a new company. Yeah, they're just trying to understand this whole public company thing.
What do we do? Well, later this week, speaking of going public and speaking of the Facebook cult, which we weren't, but now we are, the heads of some of the most powerful companies in the world are going to descend on Sun Valley to shake hands over dinner and possibly deals. Some of the media moguls will be there, include Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, Google's Sergey Brin, as well as Rupert Murdoch, whose News Corp has recently undergone some, shall we say, restructuring, freeing up some cash for other interesting investments. Charles, what's happened at this conference in the past? Sun Valley. I've never heard of it. What is this conference?
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, all these people are kind of descending on this little single strip airport and shaking hands, going and playing some golf.
Yeah, it's been going for 30 years.
Apparently it has. Can we expect any deals between any of these folks at the top?
Well, I think that it's a way of, you know, people getting to talk to each other, and people at this sort of level always like to have a chat and to find out what other people are thinking and It's a bit like Davos, where a lot of the work really gets done in all the meetings and the side panels and the, you know, in the corridors, basically. That's actually where the business gets done. And a lot of the talking and chatting is really just a premise in order to get people there. So the fact that you're going to have Sergey Brin and that you're going to have Mark Zuckerberg there is, and Jeff Bezos and, all these sorts of people, I think that's very telling. It's big business talking to itself.
And what about people like Murdoch? Obviously, he's had some problems. What kinds of things would he be interested in from Zuckerberg, from Google, from Amazon even?
Well, I think Murdoch is still interested in the internet and still interested in the possibilities of it. And now that News Corp is looking to split off the print operations and all the other stuff, the sort of the entertainment, as they call it, there's still huge potential for those online, what do you do with film, what do you do with TV, how do you make money out of it? So I think that he's really looking to take a sounding, to get the feeling of what people are talking about, what directions they think it's going to go. I mean, being in a room with Sergey Brin is actually pretty valuable just in itself, because he's really very, very smart. And if he talks about a direction that things are going in, then you can probably guess that's the direction things are going in. So actually, probably the most interesting conversation I could imagine at that conference would be Sergey Brin one side of the table, Mark Zuckerberg on the other, Rupert Murdoch at the end, listening to the two of them bat it out, because I figure that whatever came out of that, that would be pretty much the shape of the future.
Rupert Murdoch as a fly in the wall. Do you think perhaps that's that's how he's made?
It's possibly not how he thinks of himself.
Suddenly not the most important person in the room. Gosh, that'll be a real sort of shockeroo for him. And finally, in the Facebook news, the social network came under fire last week for deleting a free speech group's posts about torture in Syria. Charles, what happened there?
A group called Article 19 said that Facebook had deleted, and indeed had deleted, a status report which they had put up on their Facebook page. It said, Human Rights Watch publishes a shocking report into torture in Syria, including geotagged detention centres, and it then had a link to it. Facebook deleted it. Facebook said that it was a mistake, but Agnes Callamard, who's the executive director of the Article 19 group, said that Facebook had acted like the judge, jury and executioner.
Why is that a problem? It's a corporate entity. We signed our EULA. We ticked the box. We said agree. You can have everything. Take our firstborns, the whole thing.
Well, it's because it rather goes against the freedom of speech ethos that you'd expect to find.
You would expect to find on the, on the internet, but not necessarily
on Facebook, which
is
a US-owned company, which, being US-owned, it says rights of the US apply, which is sort of First Amendment, freedom of speech, and so on. A spokesman for Facebook said the post was mistakenly removed by a member of its moderation team, and that who receive a high volume of takedown requests. In the statement, Facebook said, the link was reported to Facebook. We assess such reports manually, and because of the high volume, occasionally content that shouldn't be taken down is removed by mistake. We're sorry about this. The organisation concerned should try posting the link again.
Have a go.
We dare you. We double dare you. You sort of wonder who's actually been reporting it. But the feeling is that it might have been the torture hashtag. And that is the thing that tripped the wires. And the moderation team's head, torture is not meant to be a Facebook thing. So, I don't know quite how they sell 50 Shades of Grey on there, but, possibly that would be getting reported and stuff.
Well, apparently it's not that racy, to be
honest.
Shall
they tell me?
Yeah, I haven't yet had a look. Well, you can download it on your Kindle. Nobody need know, Charles. Right, Nobody need know.
Just cover it up with a copy of Mein Kampf.
You don't even need to do that on a Kindle. What actually is considered inappropriate matter on Facebook? A few months ago, they published their thing.
We did. It's a really bizarre list.
Yeah,
it's things
people were
like,
freaking out about breasts. Yeah. A breast.
Can't have a breast, can't have a nipple.
Can
have breasts, but no
nipple.
Nipples.
What would they think of Sunday Sport?
Things like you can show squashed heads, but you can't show blood. It's rather peculiar. Very peculiar combinations. I mean, it is there on the Guardian site if you want to find it. And the long terms of use and it's a real rat's nest, to be honest. And it's not surprising, actually, if one of the moderators didn't quite interpret it right. Though you'd sort of hope they'd be able to tell the difference between Syrian torture and common or garden other torture. That there's actually a political element and a free speech and oppression element to it.
Well, we are human after all. Wait until the machines take over, Charles. Just wait. There will be no problems in the future. And remember, you can keep up with Tech Weekly on Twitter. It's at GuardianTW. And the Guardian Technology feed is at GuardianTech. All of these stories are on guardian.co.uk/technology. Now, our next guest is not only an Oscar award-winning filmmaker, but a notable author and software pioneer. Charles, tell us a little bit about Charles H. Ferguson.
Not many people have heard about him, it's got to be said. But he was originally a political science doctorate. He got a political science doctorate from MIT. And then the World Wide Web was just kicking off, a sort of 95, 97 sort of period. And he set up a company called Vermeer with the idea of making it easier to get content up onto the web. Because at that time, you had to be a bit of an HTML coding geek, actually, you know, and actually finding out how you did HTML wasn't easy either.
I remember it wasn't really until what they call Web 2.0 that people really started to be able to do that kind of thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was more of a hassle than, you know, CSS was barely, cascading style sheets was barely in its infancy, and I hadn't reached 2.0 at that time. So trying to get a page on the web to look like the page that you had in front of you in your word processor was really nightmarish. So he set up a company called Vermeer, and they had some killer software, which was really good. And they came to the notice of the then giant company that would steamroller everything in its path called Microsoft. And as he details in a fantastic book called High Stakes, No Prisoners, which I honestly recommend, even though it's quite old now, I recommend it to everyone working in a startup. Absolutely anyone, or anyone who's thinking of working in a startup, because his insights into venture capital, into startup life, into the way that you get screwed over by recruiters, by the people who you're hiring, by the venture capitalists, by the people who are buying you, all those insights are fantastically valuable. And he's so honest about himself and about his own failings that it's just the most compelling book. It's the first great internet book that I ever read, I have to say.
I can imagine his poli-sci background would provide some interesting context and frameworks to tackle those types of things. So he came in and you spoke with him.
So he came in and I began by just reading out the review of his book. In 1993, Charles Ferguson, MI-trained engineer, consultant, high-tech industry analyst, had a brilliant idea. The world needed a visual development software tool to create online information systems. The tool had to be visually oriented to be useful to the non-programmers who knew the information. Yet the tool had to be sophisticated to allow organizations to structure their data in useful ways. Ferguson sunk his then life savings into his idea. He created his software corporation, Vermeer. With his partner, Randy Forgard, he assembled a very good programming staff. He raised venture capital. He pursued the enterprise. And by the end of 1995, there was code that was more sophisticated than the code of potential competing programs like NaviPress, Netscape Composer, or PageMill, and that actually ran. And tell us a little bit about what happened after that, after 1995, once you had Vermeer, which was actually code that ran.
Very interestingly, amusingly, coincidentally, on the very same day, we received phone calls from Microsoft and Netscape inquiring about potential acquisition. It was clear at the time that we were going to be running up against Netscape and America Online and Microsoft as competitors. And it was also clear that we had a potential opportunity to sell ourselves to them and or make deals with them of some kind. We commenced negotiations, and in the end, we sold ourselves to Microsoft for just over $130 million in Microsoft stock.
And, just before that process, before the sale was completed, you had all the startup experiences and the book, the High Stakes, No Prisoners book, does detail a lot of the incredible hassle that seems to come about from being a startup, from being involved with having venture capitalists who want to impose their own managers and managers who want to get their own special pay packets.
Yes, it was a very complicated, demanding environment, partially because startups just tend to be that way. They tend to be very intense experiences. And the startup world is frequently not populated by the shy and retiring and gentle. That was certainly our case. In addition, we had the additional kind of added extra benefit that we were a very early internet software company, and at the time that we were developing our software, the World Wide Web was exploding. The web was growing at about 20% per month, which is pretty tough to keep up with.
So do you think that the startup environment has changed now? Do you think that, you know, people who are in startups now, do they have it easy? Do they have it hard? You know, if you look back at how it was then, is it actually just the same experience, except it's slightly translated that people have to think about Facebook rather than Microsoft now or Google?
Many things are the same. It still is a very intense experience. Things still move very fast. It's very competitive. There is one big difference, though, which is the amount of money is so much greater. The technology sector and the startup sector in 1993 through 96, which was the period during which I conceived of, ran, and then sold my company, during that time, annual venture capital investment in the United States was maybe $5 billion a year or something like that. It's at least 10 times that now, at least.
And one of the interesting things in the book is about the way that venture capital and equity works. One of the lessons that I learned from it was that Steve Jobs became a billionaire basically because he screwed over everyone at Pixar through the restructuring of the stock. What advice would you give to someone in a startup now who's looking at getting, you know, venture funding, who's thinking about selling equity? What are the steps they should take? I mean, apart from reading your book.
They should learn about the other disciplines that they need beyond the discipline in which they were trained. It was, I think, one lesson that I took away is that if you're a technical person, you need to know about non-technical things. And if you're a business person, you need to understand technology. You have to have a very synthetic, cross-disciplinary understanding of what's required. And if you miss any of those things, you're liable to make big, big, big mistakes.
And if, in effect, people can have their equity diluted so far that they don't really get any benefit, is that the...
That can happen. I think that these days, my experience is that many young engineers are much more sophisticated about business and financial things than they used to be, in part because now everybody knows that the financial stakes are very large. And that it's a tough, very competitive, sometimes very ruthless industry.
Your company Vermeer was taken over by Microsoft. From the book, there's a certain amount of things not said, as I recall, just about the sort of experience of being inside Microsoft. Do you think that Microsoft is very good at the takeover business, at the actual absorption business? Because we've recently had the news that the Quantive advertising business, which they bought for $6.3 billion, has been written down to a value of virtually zero.
Well, Microsoft has changed. When Microsoft acquired us, it was at the height of its powers. And it was, at the time, a very impressively tough, smart, ruthless organization. The people that we dealt with, that I dealt with, were incredibly smart, aggressive, tough people. Chris Peters, who at the time ran Microsoft Office, was, I wouldn't want to go up against him. He's a very smart man. But he's now retired from Microsoft, and that's symptomatic. Microsoft has changed. It's a much larger, much more bureaucratic, much less aggressive organization. It has begun to succumb to the various diseases of late middle age in large companies. It's no longer nearly as nimble or aggressive as it used to be. In some regards, that's a good thing. Microsoft used to crush anything in its path, and one of the reasons that I sold my company to Microsoft was that Chris Peters told me very directly, in a very civilized tone, he said, you know, look, Charles, it'll take us somewhere between $3 and $5 million to replicate your software, and we'll be starting out 1 year behind you, but we currently have $16 billion in cash, and I think we can probably afford it. And I said to myself, yep, Chris, you're right.
What are those diseases of late middle age that you see in Microsoft then? What are the symptoms, and what then is the prognosis?
Well, you know, when you've had, you know, $20, $30, $40 billion in cash and $10 or $15 billion in annual profits for a decade running, it's pretty difficult to keep people as aggressive and on edge as they used to be. People get comfortable, and now the place is so large that no one person can understand what everybody's doing. The management is much more bureaucratic, much less technically knowledgeable than it used to be. And as a result, you know, you see increasing politicization, you see kind of sclerosis, you see mistakes being made, you see things being done slowly.
Do you think that's a result of the antitrust trial in the U.S. particularly, or is that just a factor of getting large?
I think it's both. I think that the antitrust pressure on Microsoft of roughly a decade ago did have some effect, and the point was made to them that they had to back off a little bit. And so certainly they're not doing some of the things that, you know, 15, 20 years ago they could have and would have done. So the antitrust pressure was part of it. I think that most of it is just natural life cycle aging.
And if you look at the technology landscape today, we have companies like Apple, Facebook, Google, Amazon. What's your feeling there? I mean, for example, Google over here in Europe is currently going through some antitrust wrangling with the competition commissioner. Do you think that's going to have the same sort of effect on a company that's got lots of very smart, nimble, quick, you know, interested, aggressive people?
The antitrust pressure on Google might have some effect, but I think the main thing that will curb Google for the moment is the fact that it's competing intensely with Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. And those companies are in many ways, I think, you know, the fight of the century right now over control of the mobile internet. And the stakes are very, very large, and all of those companies are moving very aggressively, and each of them has powerful control over some piece of it, and they're all maneuvering with and against each other. And I think that that's the main thing that, at least for now, will prevent any of them from controlling the entire space.
So just give us your quick sort of feel on, you know, what's the good, what's the bad for Apple, for Facebook, for Amazon, for Google.
Well, I think that one thing that is a potential problem with and from all of them is that all of these companies in different ways, in different parts of the space, sometimes in the same part of the space, are developing their own very proprietary solutions to problems. And so Microsoft owns Skype, and Apple has FaceTime, and Google has its own thing. And one potential casualty from the nature of this competition is the interoperability that we have come to expect of the internet, where everything works well and talks to everything else. And we could find ourselves in a situation 5 or 10 years from now where there are 3 or 4 different incompatible ways to do a lot of different things: video conferencing, making phone calls over the web, etc. And that's a potential risk of large size, I think. But for the moment, I think that the world is benefiting greatly from the competition that these companies are engaged in.
It sounds almost as though we're looping back to the days of, you know, PageMill versus Vermeer, and, you know, the which was a very proprietary time for those products. I mean, don't they get commoditized in the end?
Well, they might get commoditized. They might not. I think that right now these companies are moving, for the most part, towards increasingly proprietary technologies and solutions. So far, that has not yet posed major problems for interoperability, but we already see the beginnings of it. You know, Apple FaceTime is only available on certain platforms, and applications from Android can't readily talk to applications for the iOS platforms that Apple controls. And so we are beginning to see the beginnings of kind of balkanization of the internet, which, if it continues, could become dangerous.
Charles Ferguson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Charles H. Ferguson speaking with Charles Arthur. Now, Charles, what was the name of the book again?
The book is called High Stakes, No Prisoners, and the A in stakes is often done as an at. I don't think it's available in print, though I'm pretty sure you can get it on ebook format.
Also, you can find it on various sources in the internet.
You might find it on ebooks. Hey.
That's it from us this week. Many thanks, Charles. You can read more on all these stories at guardian.co.uk/technology and keep up with the latest headlines throughout the week. Next week, we're hearing from Keith Stewart. He's at the Develop Conference in Brighton. I'm Alex Krotowski. The producer this week was Jason Phipps. We're back next Tuesday. See you then.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.